Welcome to season 19 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Welcome back, season 19, moving right along. This week's feature conversation is with Phil Burgess, and Phil is the chief people officer at a company called C-Space. If you care at all about company culture, which if you're listening to this, I'm sure you do, this episode is right up your alley. Here are a few of my just favorite quotes. Phil said, "Don't treat the symptoms, treat the fundamental cause of culture issues. If you focus on your people and fixing the culture, the business results will come. If you are a leader and you focus on people, they will work harder and do better things." I mean, this is a leadership and culture show. It's about a real world company that's gone through transformation, going from almost a toxic culture to what they are today, and then having to reinvent themselves from a culture perspective. This is real life culture, not some, you know, fantasy story. This is a company that has been through it, that have put in the work, that now are sharing their story, and I just love it. You're going to learn so much from Phil. You can check out C-Space at cspace.com. You can check out Phil on LinkedIn, Phil Burgess. I can't wait for you to listen to it. So without further ado, here is an excellent interview about company culture with my friend, Phil Burgess. This podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Leadership Academy, LearnLoft's three-month online program designed specifically to help you go from manager to leader. It includes the EO 360 assessment, an online proven curriculum, and ongoing coaching to help you become the best leader you can be in 2019. I hope you'll take this opportunity to go from not just knowledge, not just understanding, all the way to application and wisdom to help make this your best leadership year ever. Go to learnloft.com to sign up today. The price goes up in just a few days. Don't miss this opportunity to join the upcoming Ultimate Leadership Academy. Now on to the show. Well, Phil, thanks for being on the show.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Not only do you work for a very interesting company that's taken a completely different really shape to the industry, I think I would call it disrupting, but you've also done some disrupting of your own culture too over the history of this company. Start us off by just telling us a little bit about C-Space, what you do, and then the current role of chief people officer and what that means.
Sure. So C-Space, we think of ourselves as a customer agency. And I guess what we really believe in is trying to make business more human. And I perhaps the easiest way of explaining it is in the old world, agencies used to create brands and adverts and products and services by bringing the best minds together and just solving those problems for consumers. And they'd ask them what they thought of the campaigns, and then they'd make some changes and sort of send them out. I guess we believe that the businesses that are going to get ahead in the world are those that invite their customers into the process and actually understand their lives and then work with them to solve business problems. So using the sort of creative, disruptive force of the customer in their businesses to drive change, whether that's brand or whether that's a new advertising campaign or whether that's a new customer experience. So that's really sort of who we are. We're based in the US and the UK. And then I guess my role as chief people officer is a relatively new one for us. I was based in London. I was joint MD of our London office for 4 years. And then I moved over here with my family to Boston, where we're headquartered about 5 months ago into a new role. And I guess we talk a lot here about people plus work equals growth. And we've got growth down, we're growing at double digits, and we have a great culture, but we wanted to spend more time focusing on really thinking about our employee experience and making sure that set us up to deliver great work for our clients. And that was the thinking of the new role.
Well, it's an interesting idea, and I love the equation. I think it's fantastic. Was there an event that happened? Most companies, we define culture as the shared values and beliefs that guide thinking and behavior.
Yeah.
Was there an event that happened in this business or in this history that caused the management team or the company altogether to say, we actually need to put more emphasis on our people and their experience as much as our customers' experience?
There definitely was. I think we have an interesting history as a company in that we're formed out of a merger of two companies. So two privately owned companies. One was a co-creation consultancy based in London called Promise. We were a smaller lifestyle business, and that's actually the business that I joined back in 2011. And then over in the States, Communispace was a large, super fast growing, pioneering market research online communities business. And we were both acquired by Omnicom, one of the big holding companies, and sort of clashed together so that they could sort of get the benefit of both of our services. And that was back in 2013, I think, if I remember rightly. And then we rebranded as cSpace. And I think both companies have been growing really fast, sort of double digits through the early 2000s. And then both companies have sort of slowed down a little bit. And as a result, our culture had become very sales focused, and then being bought by a sort of a stock exchange listed company like Omnicom meant we were then being held to quarterly targets, which meant that we were even more focused on like hitting our numbers. And I think in London, I was running a consultancy team, and my the MD of London resigned, and I was appointed to join MD with a guy called Felix. Neither of us had run a business before. And actually that the year we took over in 2015, growth had been relatively flat. And I think we inherited a business that was focused on sales, and we'd always had a good culture, but when we looked around as sort of new leaders, not really knowing what we were doing, we looked around and just felt like morale was kind of low. We were struggling a little bit with our new brand. We didn't really know who we were as an agency. Were we focused on insight or innovation or co-creation? And I guess one of the triggers for this, we did an employee engagement survey in the March, April of 2015. And the results came back. And I remember vividly getting them and then having to stand up and feed them back to the company. And when we looked at who was proud to work at cSpace, I think it was something like 56% of people were proud to work here. Only 40% of people felt that they would still be in the company a year later. And I guess we sat down and as new leaders, we were also running around just sort of moaning about why everyone seemed unhappy and trying to put out fires everywhere. And in the end, we sort of sat down together, and I was lucky that I had Felix as kind of a sparring partner on this kind of stuff. Otherwise, I think it would have been pretty lonely. But we sort of said we needed to do something radical and actually start not by treating the symptoms, but treat the fundamental cause of why we weren't really why we'd lost our mojo. And that was sort of that was what triggered the decision to focus on sort of proactively shaping the culture we needed to get us back to growth. Does that answer your question?
It absolutely does. And it which leads to maybe what probably all of our audience is thinking, which is you lose your mojo, you go to the source versus the symptoms. Did you know immediately, or did you just guess that there was substantial value associated with getting that mojo back? You know, some people look at an employee engagement survey and see those numbers and be like, well, we're beating some people. But this obviously affected you personally in a way that you didn't like. Did you know that the business results would change by changing the culture? Or at the time, was it just, you knew it was important to fix the culture?
I mean, I think instinctively we knew that if we focused on people, and fixing the culture, the business results would come. But I guess that comes from previous roles where I guess I believe passionately that if you're a good leader and you focus on people, they work harder, they're more engaged, they do better things. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it was definitely challenging that first year because I mean, I was super passionate about overhauling the way our reporting managers did things and bringing in a proper HR team because we didn't actually have one at the time in London. But actually, because our growth was slower that year, what we found was actually financially, we couldn't afford to do a lot of the things that we wanted do. So that sort of led us to sit down and say, well, we do need to tackle this cultural challenge, but we also need to level with our people and lay out a bit of a plan, because we're not going to do this in year one. And we actually laid out a sort of a 4-year vision to try to buy ourselves a little bit of time. And it was as much sort of gut and doing that as actually having a real plan. But we sort of said, like, in year one, we do need to keep focused on growth, because if we're not growing as a business and if we're not making profits, then firstly, we wouldn't keep our jobs. We wouldn't have the money to invest back in our people, in training, in L&D, in better packages. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't buy ourselves the time to actually focus on the culture, because we'd be out pitching for work. So that became sort of year one, let's fix the basics and get the foundations right. And then back to the sort of people plus work equals growth, we then messaged really hard the fact that because we had sort of righted the ship and growth was good that year, we'd sort of grew sort of 3-4%. The money that we made, that we were able to plow back into our people and sort of signal to them that we were going to improve pensions by a small amount. So it was a small signal that actually, if we focus on this stuff, we're going to improve. So I guess that was one of the underlying pieces. But then it was really just what do we do to actually write our culture?
Right. Well, before we get into exactly what you did, which I really want to know, I think so many people out there, I find leaders and companies kind of fall into three buckets. One, the first bucket, Phil, is they really know the value of leadership and culture, and you don't have to teach them about it. They know that it's everything. Mm-hmm. Then there's a second bucket that says they're interested or they know it, but when the rubber hits the road, it's the first thing that goes in a way. Yeah. And then the third group, you know, they're not interested at all. It's what are the results? What's the revenue? What's the sales? What's the return? Whoever's running it doesn't really matter, et cetera. If talking to all three of those groups, what do you believe is the value associated with improving culture?
I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but I guess I'm a subscriber of the culture eats strategy for breakfast. I don't know who said it, but I think
it was Peter Drucker. Yeah, Peter Drucker.
Yeah, so I think that's where I would sit. And if you have the right kind of culture, and if you're working on it in an intentional fashion, I think it can drive the change you want. So I would definitely sit in that camp.
The second one, the other big question that comes up in our world a lot, which is some team members aren't interested, others are. Speaking of your example at C-Space, you clearly and your partner in England had a passion for making change. Did everyone on the management team feel the same way? And if not, what did you have to do to start getting those people on the bus to say, this is something we absolutely have to do?
Yeah, I mean, it was difficult because, I mean, I think we were young, recently promoted MDs who hadn't done this before. So I think in some ways we were a bit of the best option at the time. And it was a bit of an experiment, like personality-wise, I'm an ENFP, Myers-Briggs type, Felix is an INTJ. So we were kind of an interesting partnership. And it was new for us because we had become more senior at the time than some of our, I guess, people who were previously our peers. So I think we both felt we had a lot to prove and were struggling a little bit with that. And we had this gut feel that we needed to focus on culture, but we also had to kind of keep the lights on and keep winning work. And the leadership team did get behind us. I mean, we had a great leadership team. We did have a couple of people who weren't right for the business, and we had to, they left. And again, that was a tough thing for us to do at the time. And then we enrolled them. One of the things we did was there was a character, and he wouldn't mind me saying this, Ed Hurton, and he was instrumental in driving through the culture change that we did. And he is by his own admission, he can be a challenging character. And he had challenged us to say, think more about culture. And we asked him to sort of lead the efforts with the team to think about, like, what are the good and bad elements of our culture. So one of the key things we did was bring in people who we knew would be instrumental, as they needed to believe in this. So rather than us run the process, we asked Ed, as one of our exec directors, to kind of lead it, and we gave him a brief of some of the sort of the bad stuff about our culture that we want mm-hmm. to think about changing.
Well, then I think, you know, what I'm sure everybody is thinking is, well, how do you go about changing culture? I mean, because everybody in some way, shape, or form wants to improve their culture. I mean, we believe there's 5 levels of culture, 1 being toxic and 5 being elite, everywhere in between. Everybody wants to get to level 5, but getting there is very difficult. So it's 1 little bit at a time, much like your 4-year plan. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you and your team have done or continue to do even that proactively shape the culture in the direction you want it to go?
Oh, it's a good question. And I mean, I think looking back, there's tons of different things that we did. And I can talk to one of the things that was probably most instrumental. But before that, I mean, one of our philosophies as a company is relationships are the source of results. And we do that in our consulting work and our work with consumers. But I mean, we did spend a lot of time in the early days creating space and time to build relationships. One of our other beliefs is you have to sort of move beyond the professional to the personal. So as a leadership team, we tried to sort of get to know each other, and again, cheesy stuff like starting meetings by talking about like something we did at the weekend, and sharing something that scares us, and helping to like break down some of those boundaries. Mm-hmm. We sort of brought the business in and we really focused, and again, it remains an ongoing focus for us, and we don't always get it right, but like being more transparent. So certainly when we took over, people were sort of frustrated. We moved from like a scrappy entrepreneurial kind of horrible little office, which we hated. But then when we got moved into a glass building, everyone was sort of frustrated that we'd become corporate. And people were frustrated that the breakfast wasn't good enough, and it stopped at this time. And I remember we called this meeting, and it was all about being more transparent. And we sort of said to people, we actually took them through an hour long presentation on our P&L and opened up our whole sort of P&L to the business and said, look, this is really what we can spend. And this is why we're talking about profits. It's not because we're profit hungry, but it's because that allows us to invest in the business. And this is our discretionary spend. And we I guess Felix and I felt at the time, we would get in rooms and we're like, oh my gosh, I feel like a dad. Like I feel like team out there are our children, and we're in this sort of weird parental thing trying to solve everyone's problems, and we're overwhelmed. So how do we have more adult-to-adult conversations with people? And I think that became a bit of a foundation for us, where we're actually, over the years where we've got stuff right and wrong, it's given us a platform and permission to actually say to the business, you know what, we tried this and we kind of messed up. Our management team isn't as diverse as it should be, but we're working on it. Like, let's have a conversation about that. Like, we're overhauling our paternity pay. We can't afford to do this and that. And that has both brought us, I think, some forgiveness for mistakes we've made, but also fostered trust. So I suppose those are a couple of things. And then probably the biggest thing we did was actually say, we didn't really, certainly in London at the time, have a set of values that drove our culture. And the task that we sort of asked Ed to drive through was creating a new set of values or behaviors that would start to set a standard for how we operated culturally. Should George tell you a little bit about that?
That would be excellent. That would be excellent. Because, well, one of the things that we talk about all the time are, you know, core value. People aren't, a lot of organizations have core values, right, Phil?
Yeah.
But many of them are on walls or on websites, and they're not lived out every single day in the least bit. In fact, they're often lived out the opposite of those core values. And so we talk a lot about on this podcast and many places that, you know, talented people are not interested in the defining of core values, but those core values being lived out.
Yeah.
So how do you reward, recognize, and talk about those core values on an ongoing basis is how they really come alive. So talk a little bit about how these core values came to be. What's one or two of your favorites, and then how you reward, recognize, and talk about them on an ongoing basis.
And I think, I mean, this story for me is much more focused on our London office. I mean, certainly Community Space had a set of values which they really lived and were super passionate about. But for us in London, and we had grown more out of the promise side of the business, we never had anything. So, I mean, the first thing we decided was that actually it was less about values and more about behaviors. So we talked about the behaviors we wanted to drive and accepted that people's personal values were actually quite different. And we didn't want to dictate those. And then Ed pulled together a cross-functional team of people from different levels and different functions and different tenures across the business, about 15 people, which was probably about, 20%, maybe 15% of our team at the time. And they did some sort of simple exercises where firstly they thought about us on our best day and what does that look like. And then they also did some exercises around what were the behaviors that they saw in themselves and others that sort of caused pain and frustration across the business. And again, we're a storytelling business, so they told stories about some of the, it was more like a confessional. So senior people talked about like some of the things that they were slightly ashamed of that they had done, which they knew had caused frustration to others. So like one of the directors shared a story about how he went home at 6 o'clock and sort of left his team holding the burden of the work because he needed to get home and he should have really stayed to help, but he didn't. People talked about like how they would stick their hands up for something because it got them CV points, but then maybe not follow through on stuff. And again, it was a very safe space.
What are CV points?
I guess people who had stuck their hands up for extra responsibility and then not followed through on their actions.
So a few of them were, I mean, I've got this.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got this is one of the behaviors that came out of that. And it was sort of born out of the fact that we or the team felt that they couldn't necessarily look around the business and totally rely on people to follow through on what they said they would do. So I got this, the spirit of that is if you say you're going to do something, then you follow through on that. Mm-hmm. Another one was show the love. And again, that was born out of the fact that people felt that we'd recruited a load of really ambitious, high-performing people, and we were pushing to hit our numbers every month, but we weren't taking time just to stop and celebrate and give credit where it was due and just care about people beyond like them being C-space workers.
Right.
And then some of them were more broader things. Like there was a general feeling that having been acquired, that we'd sort of made it. But then when we looked at our work, we were like, can we genuinely be proud of everything we're sending out the door? So only accept awesome was sort of a push to say, even though we've now been acquired and we're part of this big holding company, like we have to keep pushing the boundaries and doing different. We can't stay we can't just be about like financial growth. So, and the team came up with the language around them. And although it sounds a little cheesy and certainly in the UK, people were a bit like, oh, this is this sort of like American value stuff going to go down well. But I think because the team came up with it and they came up with the expressions and they launched them to the business rather than leadership, people bought into them.
It's fascinating. And the thing that I really want to highlight that I personally love so much is, you know, you can get a list of 42, 50. One of our clients has had 29 when we started. I mean, I can't remember 20. I can remember three things I did today, much less 29. But what I really like here is that you've really personalized them, right? It's not just one word like accountability or, you know, honesty or work hard. You know, there's a little bit of a customization I'm searching for the word, Phil, but it feels very much like yours versus somebody else's, even though anybody could have come up with that sentence, like show the love. It's got a little bit of something that people can buy into. And it's not like you guys just met and came up with six words that any other company in the world could like.
Yeah. And certainly since launching them, I mean, some of the non-planned for stuff that's happened is like when we've put them on job descriptions and stuff, people, and as a brand sort of building our brand, people didn't necessarily know who we were, but people have been intrigued by them when we've talked about them enough to come in and interview with us, and we've definitely hired some great talent as a result. When we launched them, we sort of said these are change agents. Like we're launching these because we do want to take control of our culture, and all of us have a responsibility in shaping this every day. I guess as we launched them, like we took a pulse of the business a year in, and I think it was something like 75% of people saw positive change in their colleagues and felt that it had had a positive impact on the business. But we still were getting feedback from people that there were frustrations. Like we kind of shifted things, and people were really showing the love, and we became a much sort of it was a lovely place to work. But then it got to review time, and we were on an annual review cycle, and people would still be, why am I not being promoted? Like all I've had all year is positive feedback, and people are telling me all this great stuff, and then I'm hearing at review time that I'm not ready. And we then introduced another couple. One was tell it like it is, and one was open up and listen, to try to sort of signal to people that we also have a responsibility to each other to have honest, open conversations about stuff that isn't working, and to try and provide a safe way of giving each other feedback. And also as leadership, we need to tell it like it is to the business about the stuff we're doing well and not. Mm-hmm. And we need to open up and listen if the things that we're doing are not working for people. So again, we kind of saw these things as the next step on the journey. And I guess it's taught us that whatever you do, you have to just keep iterating them, because people can misinterpret them, and then new people join the business and you need to re-explain them. And that's remained a constant challenge.
Well, it's awesome. It's a great example. And it's a journey. It's not a destination. There's no finish line, so it's always going to be evolving, and hopefully you're growing and getting better. I think one of the things that you've had a unique differentiation in that most people might not is that originally you were part of a one office with, 80 people in it, or however many were in it. Mm-hmm. Now you're in this role of chief people and operations officer with 350 people over three different offices, and probably some people working remote and some people working in offices. And how has that changed your view or your thought around culture and those businesses that are either more spread out with multiple offices in different regions or the remote work model? What advice would you give to them?
Wow, that's a really good question. And something I'm right in the thick of right now. I mean, it definitely is different, because like we were 110 people, like all in one room. So there's more natural connection points for people to bump into each other. It's really easy at the end of every week to get the whole company together, have drinks, do sort of shout outs for people that are doing a good job of living our values, and sort of create those sort of symbolic cultural moments. Across three offices, it's difficult, because I think often when you're trying to, I guess I believe a lot in like the symbolism of these things. So like in London the other week, Felix shut the office for an hour, and just had everyone pair up with someone and go for coffee, because he felt that people were becoming a bit siloed. For us to do that here requires us to coordinate that across three offices on different time zones. And then like 12% of our team work remotely across lots of different states. And sometimes when you're trying to create those sort of cultural moments, you can end up diluting the experience because you're trying to appeal to everyone. Mm-hmm. Or you can end up doing nothing at all, because actually to create a great experience for our people in Boston is hard when you know that by having a great interactive workshop, all the people on the phone dialing in are gonna feel excluded. So I think what we're sort of experimenting with is sort of saying like, well, we need a unifying set of values and principles, and we need to create a culture at C-Space that is sort of common across all offices, but we also need distributed authority, and we need the people who are running different regional offices in New York and San Francisco to have their own take on culture. And we're also experimenting with sort of a hub and spoke approach. So we have a central services team, so I head up people and operations. But then we need people within each of our sort of sector teams and our regional offices to sort of connect in with that hub, to start to sort of break down silos and share, the great stuff that they're doing in one region with another region. But I think you have to be even more intentional than when you're in one office, because a lot less stuff happens naturally.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because you know, when you're in the same office, you see people, you know what's going on. You have a tendency to know when someone's unhappy or not engaged in their work or not putting out their best effort. It starts to get spread out. It gets very challenging. But we're only moving to more of that. And that's what's, I think for someone in your role or for anyone listening that works from home or, has multiple offices, this is a real challenge that has emerged because of the move towards a more dispersed or workforce. And it's just really interesting to hear how you're trying to handle it in real life and at the same time, get your arms around it. It's fascinating.
It's hard. And I think even like, as we think about like leadership and how we empower people to feel confident to make their own decisions and not ask for permission, in a big organization where over the years we've put in more structure and process, and hierarchy in some respects. And that's where I feel like at the moment we have an opportunity with our values and the behaviors that we've sort of launched. To actually, we're going through an exercise at the moment to reset them somewhat, because I think over the years we've now sort of we use the same ones here in the States as we launched in London, and we need to signal to people that the behaviors that sit under the catchphrases are just as important as we think about these new things that we're trying to change. So showing the love now needs to you need to think about what that means for a remote worker. So sticking up a post-it note in the office doesn't work anymore. You need to send them an email or pick up the phone or be considerate of them when you're dialing into a meeting. So they're useful and they need constant work.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny. We were doing a leadership workshop for a similar size company, and they had people that work remote and in different offices, video conference in on Google and Hangouts. And we finished the 1 hour, lunch and learn. And at the end, I just told our key contact, I said, you know what? I'm really sorry. I completely forgot about the audience online, mm-hmm. It was non-intentional. So to your point, and I know that's a workshop or a lunch and learn, but I think it's something we all have to be aware of is, to not, just because they're in their office doesn't mean they get preferential treatment over those that are outside it or are working from home or that are in San Francisco versus Boston. And it's a hard thing, Phil. And I'm really applaud you for thinking outside the box here. I think you said one thing. I certainly want to get to some of the fun stuff here. You mentioned culture being the real driver for growth. What if someone doesn't believe that, or someone's not buying into those six core values? What are the ways that you guys handle that? Or is there a protocol, or, is it just communications? What are the things that you do? Because I'm sure you're hiring for them now beforehand, but what do you do when someone slips through the cracks and they're in the business and they're not living them out?
Oh, there's a lot wrapped up in that question. So, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things I'd say firstly is like, I do believe that culture is a driver for growth, but I also think you have to remain focused on growth often to enable you to focus on culture. And I would like to think that if our growth dipped, that our culture would see us through. And I know that some of the things that we have the luxury to focus on at the moment because we're growing, we would find harder, and you would definitely be under pressure to sort of deprioritize stuff. I think I'd probably say attaching those things to culture is actually what's important. So like, if I think of what's helped drive our growth, it is focusing on culture, but it's also tightening our value proposition. And it's about sort of focusing on our clients, but through the lens of our values and our culture. So like, when we're working with our clients, how do we make sure that they experience our culture in the way that we work with them and in our tone of voice and in the way that we push them? So one of our values is do what scares you. We need to sometimes push our clients to do what scares them, partly because we want to get to a more strategic role within their business. We sometimes want to move beyond our current stakeholder to a different department or team. So that helps us grow, but it's sort of seen through our cultural lens of doing what scares us, and having the courage to sort of say, hey, we're already working with the insight team, but you've never worked with our customer experience team. So I think linking culture and growth, and actually internally, one of the reasons we talk a lot about people plus working plus growth is we try and say all three of those pillars are equally important. And actually the way we tie them all together is culture. So that's the first point. And I think your second point was like, what do we do if people are not living our values or aren't a good fit for the culture?
Yeah,
it's hard. Exactly. I think we've had success over the years. Like sometimes those people, we do exit them from the business. I think we also have started talking more about cultural ad. And I think there is a risk, particularly as we think about how do you build more diverse, inclusive businesses where we're not all just recruiting people that look and sound like us and have the same backgrounds. And I think in like agency world, it's really easy to end up with sort of white middle class agencies where everyone has come from the same background and sees things in the same way. So, I mean, certainly when we're recruiting, we're saying cultural ad, are people gonna bring in a different perspective? Do people have a different background? And are we intentional about that? And then when we bring them into the business, how do we make sure that our culture, we're not just doing things the C-space way, but we're also bringing in different perspectives and letting those people share their views, whether it's mm-hmm. because they've come from a different background or a different country, or whether it's because they come from a different discipline. And again, that's a constant challenge too, because it's harder to work with people who aren't like you than it is to work with people who are like you.
Right.
But they're little small things, and we're making progress. And I think like a lot of agencies, like we have a long way to go, I think, before we're where I would love us to be.
I hear you. Well, it's just a fascinating story, and I really can't thank you enough for sharing it. Let's get on to the fun stuff here. What is harder, Phil, leading at work or leading at home?
I think leading at home is harder than leading at work. I feel like at work, I do a good job most of the time. And then I'm kind of spent sometimes by the time I get home with two kids. Like what, I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. So when I do sometimes catch myself doing all the stuff to my children and my family that I would not tolerate at work. So yeah, I think leading at home is harder.
Yeah. Well, it might also be the ages of the kids too, but yeah, there's phases too with those. I guess when they get to teenagers, it'll definitely be harder at home. You get to leave our audience with one bit of advice today, Phil. What would it be?
Wow. I think it's probably know where you want to get to. Don't worry so much about figuring out exactly how you're going to get there, but have a really clear picture of where you're wanting to go. So if I think of us, like we were really focused, even when we were at our low point, on building a great place to work. And at the time, that seemed like a ridiculous aspiration. So I'd say have a clear place of where to go. And then I think my build on that would be do lots of small things right. Just keep tweaking and tweaking and tweaking and tweaking and tweaking. Like sometimes you need big, bold moves, but I feel like we actually got to where we are now by actually just being dissatisfied enough to keep changing things. And the combination of those things helped us sort of get to where we wanted to go.
Well, it's excellent advice. Whether you, I think it's one, the fact that you took some time to think about it, and two, could lay out for audience that it's not always about the transformational stuff like everybody says. And regardless of the role that you're in your organization, you can do a little bit better each day, and it will add up.
Yeah, I think so. I think I learned this from Felix. I think being intentional about everything. So everything you do, people are looking at, and every little thing you do has some kind of impact and it has some kind of unintended consequence. And you can overthink things, but just be intentional about those little things, and they do really add up way more than I ever thought would be possible.
Well, that's excellent. Where can people find out more about you and C-Space, about y'all's work? Where's the best place for people to go learn more?
So they can check out cSpace on our website at cSpace.com, which is just like it sounds. I'm always interested to connect with interesting people on LinkedIn. So they can look me up, Phil Burgess, on LinkedIn.
Well, Phil, we can't thank you enough for coming on the show, sharing such a great story from kind of the bottom of what culture falling apart to where you are now. And I'm sure you're going to continue to get better with people like you leading the charge. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.